depress said button.
Button clicked. We're rolling.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercer. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film, music, theatre, television, anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and I lately.
And we surf that spectrum of entertainment on Crave today. And while I've paddled the hard yards here in New Zealand, Simon, you've crested the wave of entertainment across the Tasman, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. Who wrote this stuff? Yes, inundated I was, Steve. Although, actually, I was only in it, not only, I was in Australia for a family wedding, which is a very nice reason to be in Australia.
Well, you do need a reason, don't you, to be fair?
You do. And while I was there, apart from some lovely family time, I did catch a pretty groovy little band in Melbourne at the wedding. and later, I saw a movie with Sharon's family up in Queensland. And then on the flight home, which you can, of course, is an opportunity to see lots of movies, I did see one I have heard a lot about, was keen to see it for myself, and I'll tell you a bit about that a little later. And you, sir, have been to the theatre.
Oh, yes, very, very, very sophisticated, if you don't mind. I've been to see Promise and Promiscuity, which you may be familiar with, certainly the lead performer, Penny Ashton.
From Radio New Zealand, who's a regular guest on the afternoon's programme, and the panel, I think.
The very fellow.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
And she wrote this, did she?
Wrote it, performed it. It's she shares a writing credit with Jane Austen.
Very nice of Jane to let her have that.
It is indeed. While you were off swanning around in Australia, although to be fair, it does sound like you were keeping up your end of the bargain while you were there. But
yes.
you missed Waiting in the Sky, the David Bowie tribute that we previewed a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I know. That was one regret I did have. I had a lovely time away, but that I was really looking forward to do it, especially seeing that, especially as we had a pretty nice taste of things to come in that rehearsal we attended, Steve.
Yes, we did. And what you saw in the rehearsal was basically what we got in the show. We'll talk more about that later. But, you know, for those of you who want a quick sneak preview, it was brilliant.
Oh, good stuff. Anyway, I'm sure you flew the Crave masthead while I was away with great panache and style.
Well, somebody had to, didn't they?
that's right, yes.
So should we kick off with films?
We shall.
Now, there's one that you actually took time out of your busy Australian schedule to see, was the new Melissa McCarthy comedy, yeah? The Boss.
Yes.
Now I know you probably went in with different expectations from me, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, because, of course, for me, The Boss was only one The Boss.
Absolutely.
In the popular culture sense, I mean. And that's Mr. Springsteen. But I don't think, with all due respect to her, that Melissa McCarthy is going to challenge Bruce for that title anytime soon. That's what I thought, anyway. I just thought to say I didn't laugh during the film, Steve. I did have some laughs. But, gosh, the plot was pretty predictable, I thought. The characters were mostly pretty predictable. The basic plotline is young orphan girl struggles to the top of the business world, but she gets there and without having a family at her side. Then along comes a big crisis, and so will a family who she's sort of nearby, near at hand, will this family be the one she finally accepts and becomes part of? No prizes for guessing the answer. Steve, what did you make of it?
Well, I've got my notebook in front of me as we speak, and there's one word that leaps off the page to me, and that word is grotesque. I thought this was, I mean, you said before, no disrespect to Miss McCarthy, I don't think after this film she deserves any respect whatsoever. This is one of the worst films I have seen in a very, very long time.
Wow. Okay, take me through the depths of its awfulness.
I think I know what she was aiming for. I think you can see there was an attempt to do sort of pushing the edges, gross out comedy in places. She was trying to be edgy. She was trying to be boundary pushing. And in the end, to me, it felt simply ugly and transgressive. There was one scene in particular where I suddenly realised, no, I can't stand this film a moment longer. And oddly enough, it was a scene where the people in the next row were howling like baboons.
Right.
It's the scene, you might remember it, Simon, if you haven't managed to purge this from your memory already. She's out of prison and she's trying to get back in with her old world. And she shows up at a country club where a bunch of rich financier types are sitting around a table having lunch.
Yes.
And she makes a crack about one man's wife and he mentions that she's dead.
Right.
And you go, okay, there's comedy value in that. There's a bit of a squirm. And then five minutes later, she comes after she's been told to bugger off, quite rightly too. She makes another crack about the wife, and the husband says, yeah, you know she's dead, right? And then she goes off on an absolutely horrific, odious little riff about how the dead wife, while she was still alive, was sleeping with every geek in the IT department and is probably now working her way through hell's IT department.
Yes,
And I could see what she was trying to do here, and I could see that she crossed the line after about the first 5 seconds of the gag, and then she kept on milking it for about another 30 seconds, and all I wanted her to do was stop. It was nasty, it was mean-spirited, it was ugly, it was... I mean, there's a scene, which is, I believe, also in the trailer, of preteen girls having a brawl in the street.
Yeah, yep.
I'm sorry, that's not funny. It's nasty. It's mean-spirited.
Actually, nasty is a word that is quite a useful word here, because in trying to push the boundaries, she takes it to a nasty area, like not just girls having a fight, but actually a serious fight with, you know, heavy blows being struck and bodies flying in all directions, which initially you might think, oh, there's some sort of slapstick comedy element to that, but it's done in a way which does make you feel a bit uncomfortable.
Yes.
And I agree with you that you can see where she's trying to get to. It's kind of almost like saying, hey, men do this sort of stuff, I can do it too. A woman can be involved in a story like this. Women can take the main roles. I suppose you could say there are some points to be scored there. But in trying to, this sort of ballsy in-your-face style that she has, it's almost like, as you say, Steve, not knowing when to stop. She sees that as almost part of her shtick.
Yes.
That's where she's going with it. But, yeah, look, I did laugh sometimes, but other times, yeah, I was squirming. And there's not a lot of sophistication in this. It's pretty crude. Although I thought it was quite funny. There are a lot of young girls in this film, probably 12, 13, 14, I don't know, that sort of age group. But I'm not sure necessarily you'd take a lot of 12, 13-year-olds to see the film. I suspect you wouldn't.
No, you really wouldn't. There is a degree to which I suspect this is probably being pushed as part of a new wave of films that have been coming out lately that McCarthy's been part of. I mean, Bridesmaids is probably the high watermark in all of this, where you've got women doing the comedy that's traditionally been the domain of men. And it's good that women should be allowed to operate on an equal footing with men. Except the problem with something like Bridesmaids is that McCarthy was in that, and she was seasoning. She was a bit of salt, a bit of spice.
Yeah,
And when you put a bit of salt, a bit of spice in a dish, you liven it up. But what you don't then say is, well, hey, if a little bit of salt makes it taste good, how about you put a pound of salt in it? That'll make it taste even better, right? And I think that's the mistake they made here. She can be a little bit of leavening in a film, and she can add something, but you can't build a film around that. There was a Woody Allen film many, many years ago. I'm trying for the life of me to remember what it was, and I can't put my name on it. But there's one central scene where Alan Alda plays a washed-up comedy screenwriter, if I remember correctly, and a young writer asks Alan Alda's character, how do you define funny? How do you know that something's funny? And this is a long time ago I saw this film. I never understood at the time what he was saying. He said, if it bends, it's funny. If it breaks, it's not. and I think watching The Boss, suddenly I understood what point was being made there. This didn't bend. It broke. It shattered. It was taken far too far, and it just didn't work. Which leads me to a question that we need to address.
Yes,
Peter Dinklage.
I was going to come to him. Yes.
Kathy Bates.
Yes.
Do you think possibly Melissa McCarthy's got a box of compromising Polaroids of those guys somewhere?
You do wonder. I mean, Kathy Bates, an Oscar winner. A really good actress, Peter von Dinklage, who's been in a couple of, he's obviously incredibly well known around the world from Game of Thrones. Well, I think he's really good in Game of Thrones, but he hams it up so much in this film. Oh, golly me. It's just kind of embarrassing a couple of times. Anyway, I don't know. Yeah, you might be right. Maybe that she's got, I think at the moment she's seen as a pretty big, a rising force, or she's got there and people are drawn to her, but I wonder how long it's going to last. I
desperately hope that this will be the film that finally does for her, because sooner or later somebody has got to say enough. I mean, it's I mentioned before that there's a feminist thread going on here of women getting an equal break.
Yeah.
Let's completely dismantle that one. You know, do you know who directed and wrote this film?
Who was it again? I can't remember. Who?
Ben Falcone is his name. He's Melissa McCarthy's husband.
Aha.
If you wanted to be cynical about this, you could make some profoundly disparaging remarks about the fact that the only way she could get this film made was with her husband. Mm. I'm not sure I want to go there, to be honest, but quite frankly, no, that neither of these people have any business making films in future. I mean, oddly enough, I found it profoundly misogynistic.
Yes, I know what you mean. I wouldn't go quite as far as saying she should never try another film. And I see she's in the trailer. I saw she's part of a group coming up in the new take on Ghostbusters. It might be better if there's less of her, going back to your saying about Salt. But my final thought is it was such a predictable story. We've seen it so many times before.
Oh, I'm sorry, there was a story.
I tried to sum it up in one sentence. And, you know, you knew where the film was going to take you. So there wasn't... It was really just a matter of how well they did the little ride, and it was. Look, I don't think I wouldn't really recommend you go see this, really, unless you have just wanted to be laugh at some sort of slapstick crude humour for a little while, and not necessarily laugh a lot.
I think possibly if you're an 11-year-old boy, or you've been very, very bad and need to be punished. No, I don't think you should go and see this film.
Right, ringing endorsement from Mercep and McCabe. Can I ask you about another film that you did see, Steve? I didn't, but I saw it coming up. It was, I think this is the second of the films that have gone by the general title of The Huntsman, which is sort of this take on the Snow White story.
Yes, that's right. This is The Huntsman : Winter's War. This is part of this new thing of the films in these franchises where they don't bother putting them in sequence. It's not The Huntsman 2. They just give them subtitles.
Right.
And I'm struggling, you see, to find good things to say about it, interesting things to say about it, because it's not easy. Let's see.
Good names in this. Some quite high-profile actors.
There's some great names in it. I mean, to give you a quick plot synopsis, such as it is, you know, you say it's part of this whole Snow White and the Huntsman world. But the original film was Snow White and the Huntsman. Snow White gets passing references. I think the back of her head appears in the film briefly. We've let go of Snow White completely now. This is no longer... although it operates within the same world. And so you've got Charlize Theron playing Ravenna, who's the evil queen, who wanted to do for Snow White in the first film, who out of nowhere has suddenly grown a sister that we didn't know about. Emily Blunt plays Freya, I beg your pardon.
Right.
Which immediately begs Frozen comparisons.
Especially
when Freya buggers off up north to a frozen kingdom where she's now the Ice Queen. And she's now decided, because of something dreadful that her sister Ravenna did to her, she's now decided that there must be no love in her world, and she has all the children in her country brought to her castle where they must live a totally cold and heartless and loveless life. Exactly.
Right.
And when two of these people, one of whom is the person who eventually becomes the Huntsman, never has a name as far as I can tell. Chris Hemsworth plays him as an adult.
Yes.
And there's also a second one, a younger girl, who eventually is played by Jessica Chastain as an adult. They fall for each other. And so they are cast out in various hideous and horrible ways. And then the next thing you know, suddenly there's now dwarves involved. And they're on a quest for the magic mirror that's part of the old Snow White legend that we'd forgotten about anyway. So there's plot details that get brought in and then discarded, then brought back when it's convenient. And all you can think in the end is, this film wants nothing more than to be Game of Thrones. Seriously, so much of it. There is Game of Thrones reference after reference after reference. Emily Blunt's character Freya basically is dressed up as Daenerys Targaryen. Costume, hairstyle, everything is Daenerys Targaryen. She builds walls of ice. Where did they get that idea from? And, I mean, it just keeps on going on over and over. Freya eventually is... Are you much of a Game of Thrones follower, Simon?
I am, actually, yes. Right.
She's a warg at one point. It's all in there. It's all Game of Thrones. I mean, I just kept ticking off the reference. There's a dwarf. Well, obviously there's dwarves. It's Snow White. But, you know, these days, when you get within that kind of context, you toss a dwarf in, you think, oh, pity's sake, more Game of Thrones? It's just not very good.
I'm gonna put a break on just one little thing. Warg.
Yep.
I could be getting my cultural references all mixed up. I thought the wargs were in The Lord of the Rings. Have I got that right?
You know, are they
also in Game of Thrones?
It's entirely possible that George R.R. Martin did get the idea from Lord of the Rings. It's a long time since I've read my Tolkien.
People will write in, you know.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. You say anything out of turn about either of those two. But again, there's Lord of the Rings parallels in this film. There's evil goblins, obviously, that look like they've been... that look, frankly, like an outtake from the new Planet of the Apes films. There's the mirror is something that people covet but makes you go evil, which is the ring, let's face it. I mean, it's so utterly derivative. There's so many things. I mean, I was picking out bits from Spider-Man, from Terminator 2. seriously, you know, at one point, Charlize Theron looks like she's channeling Joanna Lumley out of Absolutely Fabulous. It's all over the place. And all of this would be acceptable. All of this would be tolerable if it weren't for the fact that they rope in, what are they now? Nick Frost and Rob Brydon as a couple of dwarves. And then Sheridan Smith and Alexandra Roach as another couple of dwarves who start off antagonising them and end up, well, less antagonistic toward them. And you've got four profoundly able comic talents there who are criminally, criminally wasted. You just think, no, please. This should have been better. It could have been better. And it just feels like somebody had a great idea with Snow White and the Huntsman, and it sold a lot of money. And so you now end up with basically a sequel that nobody wanted, nobody's enjoyed, no one's done well. And I mean, it's going to make scads of money. It's going to make Brazilians of dollars, and it doesn't deserve to.
Yeah, it sounds like the word that I'm getting listening to you is muddle. Just a big muddle. Everything thrown in
I'll take that. Yeah, that'll do quite nicely. Yeah. I've obviously conveyed it well because that'll do nicely as a good summation. I mean, to be fair, you know, driving home in the car afterwards, Debbie was saying that she thought that the central relationship between Chris Hemsworth's Huntsman and Jessica Chastain's Sarah was quite sweetly done. She's got a point there.
Right.
But that was one little thing that got lost in, as you beautifully put it, this hideous muddle of stuff. And the less said about their accents, the better.
Oh.
Oh, dear Lord. I mean, seriously, go back and watch Mary Poppins. You'll think Dick Van Dyke nailed Cockney.
Right. Okay. Hoo-wee. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll be rushing out and getting a ticket for that one.
No, you won't. No, you won't. Trust me. You won't. Weak. Very, very weak.
Okay. Yeah. Right. If you wanted to know, this is Crave. He's Steve McCabe. I'm Simon Mercer. We get together every now and then. We chat about movies and music and theatre and all manner of things in the entertainment world. Okay. Let's leave The Huntsman, shall we?
I think we should, and I think we should try and find something that we can be positive about.
All right. Well, I'm going to just briefly, I won't go into this too long, but on the way back from Australia, Steve, I had the opportunity, as one does, to watch a movie on the flight. And there was one that I was sure was going to be serious and grim and unrelenting and probably dark and not make me feel very uplifted, but I thought I really wanted to see it, and it was called Son of Saul. It has been out here for, I think, quite a few weeks now. It was the grand prize winner at Cannes. It won Oscar for Best Foreign Film. I just thought, this is the sort of film I haven't seen enough of lately doing my Crave duties, and I really wanted to have a look at it. It's Hungarian. It's set in Auschwitz during the Second World War. It tells the tale of one Jewish prisoner. The character is called Saul Auslander. He's played by a guy, and I don't know if my pronunciation might be wrong, but Geza Rorig is the name of the actor. The first thing about this, Steve, is the way it's actually filmed, and it straight away is something that makes you think, oh, this is a bit different, because it's shot or it's presented to you almost entirely from the point of view of Saul.
Okay.
Like, by that I don't mean that like the camera is his eyes looking around, but that his face or the back of his head is almost always in the frame. Not quite always, but nearly always. So this story is unfolding as you glimpse things behind him.
Oh, okay.
Often they're in soft focus, or the camera will occasionally pan away but come back to him. So that's quite clever. And it's particularly clever because you're in a concentration camp. There are some awful, awful things happening. And so because he's there, he's in the middle of it, and you're not necessarily having it thrown right in your face. It's just unfolding behind him. You get glimpses of some of the awful things that are happening, but not in a way where you just can't stand to look anymore. So I think that was quite an interesting and clever way to try and tell a story set in such an awful place. So that in itself, I think, I'm trying to think if I've seen another film like that, and nothing springs to mind. But anyway, yes, that was interesting.
How do you make a film out of this without it simply becoming relentlessly oppressive and grim?
Well, so the story is that Saul, he's one of a special class of prisoner called Sonderkommando. And this is a group of Jewish prisoners. They effectively work for the Nazis. So they are like the dog's bodies. They shepherd the new arrivals in the camp. They get them undressed. They prepare them for the furnace or the gas chamber. They get rid of their clothes. They dig scatter the ashes in the river. And all the time they do this terrible job, knowing that after a certain period of time, they themselves will get the nod and they'll go to the chamber. So what a heck of a job. The question in this story is, as Saul goes about this awful work, he comes across one body which doesn't end up going to the chamber. It's of a young boy. And you are presented with, he is presented, well, we are taught, we are seen how he attaches himself emotionally to this young boy and desperately wants to provide him with a proper Jewish funeral conducted by a rabbi. And so the story follows him in the midst of all this awfulness, trying to find a rabbi, trying to protect the body of the boy so that this lad can be properly buried. And that's the key sort of personal story. The other thing that's going on is that we are aware as the film goes on that there's a bit of a broader story about a plot amongst some of these Sonderkommando to try and stage a revolt, get out, escape to the forest. And it's that personal little mission of Saul's that gives you something to hold on to, Steve, because it's pretty bloody grim. But the interesting thing is you're wondering as you go along, is he really his son, or is he just a representative son? Is he a young boy who could be someone else's son? But
right.
to Saul, he might as well be his son. And so it's actually quite emotional just talking about it. It is. It does hold you. It's not pleasant, but it does get to some really sort of incisive questions of humanity and what we would do under the most terrible circumstances. I really would recommend it, but you know, for goodness sake, be prepared for something pretty dramatic and gripping and awful in many, many ways, but a really clever piece of cinema and not a drop of music in the soundtrack anywhere.
Right. Now, I remember a while back we were talking about Everest. And the question, the question I asked you then, because obviously that was always going to be a fairly intense watch, was, is it entertainment? And I think I know the answer to that question here. This is not going to be a film you enjoy, is it?
No, it's not going to be a film you enjoy, but it would be a film I would recommend. But I recommend that you take a deep breath and you're not going knowing this is going to be a heavy, heavy drama, but that it does. Not only is the story itself quite a gripping story, but the way, again, I come back to the way they've told it visually is interesting, and that's something that's a bit different from that I haven't seen this sort of treatment before myself. Does that ring in? Have you seen anything like that? The way I've described it?
I don't know that I have. I mean, usually the traditional views of films like films, for example, like Schindler's List is the obvious. Auschwitz film.
Yes. Yeah.
But that was a much more conventional piece of linear storytelling.
Yeah.
I mean, have you seen The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas?
Oh, I don't think I have. No, I haven't.
It's an attempt to tell a similar story from a slightly outsider's point of view. It's told from the point of view of the child of the camp commandant.
Okay. So
I think, you know, the issue you've got is you've got a very, very familiar and horrifically oppressive story, and yep. you're trying to find a way of telling the story without just simply basically getting into torture porn.
Yeah, that's right. That is right. I think in this case, that's probably why they did decide to visually tell it this way, because you skirt on the edges of that, but you're not absolutely immersed in it because it's sort of in the background. Yeah, it's quite clever, actually.
Yeah, and it sounds like by focusing on an individual, you get away from, I think, you know, Stalin's quote that one death is a tragedy, or we could spin it out and say 6 million deaths,
yes,
is a statistic. So by rather than focusing on, the Holocaust, isn't it dreadful, lots of bad things happened, focus on one person.
Yeah.
Personalize it, and then you can extrapolate there were 6 million of this person.
Yeah.
It's going to be a very, very powerful message. I think it sounds like they did it very effectively.
Oh, I think it is a very powerful and effective film to see. Anyway, I know it's been around for a little while, but it's the sort of film you might want to actually sort of later on, you know, hire it or rent it or watch it online and just at home and just sort of, you know, rather than necessarily to see it as a big night out.
Yes, anyway. Possibly not the ideal date movie.
No.
But I'm looking
for a night out. Yes, go on.
Yeah, I'm looking certainly at release dates on IMDb. I don't see a release date here or Australia.
I mean,
it's getting a worldwide release, but it's looking like, for example, it's not opening in the UK until the end of April.
Okay, I might be wrong. I thought it had been out for a week or two here, but maybe I've got that wrong. Okay, well, if that's the case, then I do recommend it, certainly. Okay, good.
Sounds good.
Oh, gosh, we need some light relief. Tell me something about the theatre that you've been to see.
Well, I went to a bizarre theatre experience last night. I went to the Garnet Station, which is basically a cafe with a little garage around the back that turned into a theatre, just above, up the hill above Western Spring Stadium.
I do actually know that. It's a very nice spot.
It's lovely, isn't it? And so Debbie and I were there last night because Penny Ashton, of Radio New Zealand fame, was putting on her one-woman show, Promise and Promiscuity.
I didn't realize a one-woman show. Okay, what did she do?
It's absolutely barking mad to begin with. Let's get out of the way. It's eccentric. It's silly. It's extremely entertaining. It's a Jane Austen style, heavily, heavily influenced and inspired by Jane Austen. It's set in 1810. Story of a young lady who needs to find a husband.
Right.
And that's basically the synopsis, I believe, of just about every Jane Austen story ever. And so it's the essence of Austen distilled down. There's maybe eight characters, all played by Penny.
Goodness.
And oddly enough, you never once get confused over who she's playing at any given moment.
Right.
She pulls it off beautifully. The pacing is fantastic. It doesn't let up for a second. The show lasts about an hour and a quarter, and you're laughing from the moment she walks on the stage.
Oh, fantastic.
The story is coherent. It is articulate. It's intelligent. She delivers it with confidence and panache. I can't speak highly enough of it. It's just absolutely superb. And I went in knowing nothing about it other than it's Penny Ashton's one-woman show about Jane Austen, and that was it. That's all I knew. and I've never heard Bon Jovi songs sung to tunes written by Beethoven, but I have now.
Oh, okay.
So there's a wonderful mix of Regency sensibilities and contemporary references that could, if done in the wrong hands, simply end up a ridiculous pantomime mess.
Yeah.
But trust me, these are not the wrong hands. This is a woman who knows exactly what she's doing, and she does it very, very well. Debbie and I laughed all the way through it, and we weren't the only ones.
Oh, good.
There were 28 people in the room, which was a packed house. And everybody was
fantastic.
Laughing all the way through.
How long is her run of this show? Do you know?
Well, rather unfortunately, the Auckland run this time round
yes.
was only 3 nights at the Garden Station, okay. And last night was the final
okay.
night. But you know, I'm glad you asked, because she's been touring this show for quite some time now. She's been taking it all over the place, and so she's about to take it down to Wellington for I think she said a 3 week season down in Wellington.
Yeah.
Then after that, she's taking it off around the world.
Oh, good on her! Fantastic.
Yeah. Next, she's taking this on to Winnipeg and then Toronto in Canada.
Yeah.
And then after that, she's taking it to the Edinburgh Festival.
Ooh,
which
nice!
I think it's absolutely brilliant.
Do you think it'll go down all right in Edinburgh?
I think it will go down an absolute storm in America. So, yeah. So I'm going to quick look at her website. We might as well give her a quick plug, because I'd encourage anybody who's not seen this to go and see it. And even if you have, go and see it again, because it's genuinely funny. Go to hotpink.co.nz, because that's Penny's website for everything that she does. Because I'm seeing here that she's playing the New Zealand International Comedy Festival in Wellington. She's there from May the 3rd to the 21st.
Okay.
And she's going to be down there. Then she's off to Toronto, then Winnipeg, then Edinburgh. And it looks like she's going to be then bringing it back to... She's doing a poetry show in Auckland on May the 14th. But
okay.
For Promise and Promiscuity, which is as entertaining an evening as you're going to get. Yeah.
Good.
If you're in Wellington, first half of May, you'd be a fool to miss it.
A very nice recommendation. Thank you. Very good. Hey, and anyway, I know we do have some people who listen to us from outside New Zealand, so you never know. There might be people who might be able to get the chance to see her offshore.
Yes.
It's all good.
Speaking of offshore, what have you seen offshore recently, Simon? Hey, that was effortless, wasn't it?
Masterful.
I was quite proud of that one.
Segway. I'm just going to tell you very quickly, and I won't dwell on it too long, but I told you I was in Melbourne for a wedding, for my niece Reese's wedding, which was lovely. And in her reception, they had a band called Wes Green with an E at the end, Wes Green and the Plastics.
Oh, yeah.
Good name. Saxophonist, guitarist, drummer, keyboards, no vocalist. Jazzy, soulful, poppy tunes, groovy, entirely appropriate for an event like a wedding reception. I don't know the Melbourne scene super well. I'm guessing there's probably 1,010 bands in a city that big, Steve. I don't know that these guys are necessarily the most well-known or the most successful, but absolutely, if you come across them and you're over there in Melbourne, Wes Green and the Plastics, they're definitely worth catching. They're aiming to get people up on their feet and onto the dance floor. They absolutely did that. I occasionally missed the vocalist, but what they did, which was quite clever, was I think they were using the saxophonist almost to take the role of a singer.
Oh, wow.
That makes sense. You know, like the vocalist, the saxophone seemed to come in and out and almost play vocal lines. That was my impression. Really feel good. I should have written down some of the song titles, because I was kind of concentrating on the wedding.
That's reasonable, yeah.
Yeah, rather than doing an absolute professional review. But
well, tell me this: were they playing their own material? Were they doing covers? What kind of show was it?
Yeah, mostly covers, stuff you would have heard before. I think the one or two that sounded a bit more original, but sort of something you might have seen on the Blues Brothers, maybe, or The Commitments, that sort of song, you know, that sort of soul-y, rocky, poppy stuff. One of the many, many bands, but great. I thought, yeah, these guys are doing really well, and not in the big time, but if you're out and about, as I say, you might see them at a cafe or a restaurant or whatever, a club. Unlike Steve, unlike, I suspect, the big names that I missed at the big Bowie tribute show, which you lucky so-and-so did get to see while I was away.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to get to see this one. This is Waiting in the Sky, which is the David Bowie tribute that we previewed a couple of episodes ago, and it's doing three dates across New Zealand. They've played Auckland already. They're also playing in, well, they played in Wellington last night. So sorry that you've missed that one. But South Islanders, mainlanders, Christchurch. Yes. If you're doing nothing on April the 19th, I know what you should be doing. This was a very, very good show. We basically sort of, as far as I can tell, masterminded by Eddie Rayner.
Yes.
And his Dark Horse band. So you've got some very, very talented musicians in there. Jim Hall and Brett Adams on guitars were phenomenal. Very, very good. And there was a rotating cast of singers.
Yes.
So we Finn Andrews from The Vales, Jordan Luck from The Exponents.
Yeah.
Alistair Riddell of Space Waltz. There was Zane Griff, who you interviewed last time.
Yep.
We've got, speaking of the Melbourne musical scene, a young lady named Olympia. And although he's actually a Kiwi, he's now based in Melbourne, Skyscraper Stan. Stan Woodhouse.
Yeah.
And they sort of rotated through a set list that opened rather daringly, I thought, with Lazarus, the lead single. From Bowie's last album, the one that basically was his Death Notice.
Black Star was the album.
Black Star was the album, and so they opened with Lazarus, which I thought was a rather brave opening. That was Finn Andrews sang that. And then we moved on to things like Space Oddity, Gene Genie, all the old stuff, all the old classic glam rock material. I mean, and it was amazing, the fantastic choice of stuff. Ziggy Stardust they played, Zane Griff sang Suffragette City, and I have to say, Zane Griff was the most worthy successor to David Bowie that I could imagine. He comported himself. If he'd lost about 20 pounds, he could have been a thin white duke. He's got that look about him. And his voice matched the music perfectly. Then after a brief interval, it was then the new stuff. And by new, I mean 1980s and onwards. So the second half opened with Ashes to Ashes. They played Golden Years, which was wonderful. And I was thinking, what's left? I mean, what David Bowie songs are left to play? They're obviously doing it sequentially. What's left? I can't think. But then they played Fame, and they played China Girl, and Let's Dance, and they played Cat People, and they played Young. I mean, it just didn't stop.
Did they do Heroes?
That was the big finale. Yes, the whole band, everyone came back on for Heroes, and that was the big climax. It was fantastic. It was wonderful. You've got, I mean, there's a couple of unexpected ones in the encore as well. Finn Adams sang Rock and Roll Suicide. And then we also had Moon Age Daydream, which is, you know, not what I expected to hear from Ziggy Stardust, but it was still very, very well done. And also, what I really liked, Jordan Luck sang All the Young Dudes.
Oh, okay.
Which, I mean, I suppose technically it is a David Bowie song, but, you know, famously he wrote it for Mott the Hoople.
Yes.
But they nailed it. They absolutely nailed it. And one thing that they did that I think is worth mentioning is a lot of the time when you get tribute records, artists will reinterpret that band's music in their own style.
Yes.
And I mean, one that springs to mind years ago, there was a tribute to Elton John, tribute album, and Kate Bush sang Rocketman. And she sang it as a reggae song.
Okay.
And it works. It sounds bizarre, but you get the idea that, you know, this was obviously her take on the song. Mm. But in Waiting in the Sky, no, it wasn't done that way. These were very, very faithful reproductions of the original songs. So when Jordan Luck sang Rebel Rebel, David Bowie did over the years a number of remixes with different arrangements of that song, different guitar openings, and he went straight back to the original. It just crunched out, and it was magnificent. Aww. Absolutely superb. Love. I have to mention one thing, in the interest of fairness.
Yes.
Simon Sweetman, who's been mentioned in these parts before, wrote, quite frankly, a hatchet job of a review of the Wellington show. He even went as far to suggest that it was a cash grab that was dreamt up in the months after Bowie's death.
Oh.
Now, I hope these guys made some money out of it. They damn well deserved to, because they were brilliant. He singled out for particular...
Derision. Yeah.
Derision will do nicely. Olympia.
Okay.
Although when she sang Life on Mars, I thought that she found the soul of that song beautifully. I thought she was absolutely lovely singing that. It was fantastic. Uh-huh. And not as thin and as weak as Sweetman made her out to be. And he described Skyscraper Stan as a cross between Jar Jar Binks and... Oh, I've completely forgotten the name now. Who's the bloke, the Kiwi bloke? They're all Kiwis, aren't they? In Flight of the Conchords, who's not Brett and Jermaine?
Oh, Rhys Darby.
Thank you. There you go. I don't know. The name, at the moment I started speaking, slipped from my mind. I hate it when that happens.
Well...
He described him as a cross between those two. And when I saw the man sing Young Americans, I was thinking this is a fantastic selection for him. He did it brilliantly.
I didn't see the show, but I did get to meet, quite a few of the singers and see them rehearse. I was with you that day, Steve.
And, of course.
And from the conversations I had with them, I got no sense at all about a bunch of people who had nothing better to do, who just decided they'd make some money on the back of David Bowie's death. That's not at all where I thought this was coming from. It seemed to me that they genuinely thought this was a highly influential and important artist in their lives. They wanted to pay tribute to the guy. And I guess in a way you could say that the fact that they did these faithful versions of the songs is almost like out of respect to him, because he was so definitive in what he did. I didn't see the actual, the show that you did, but on the basis of my interactions on that rehearsal day, I thought I was really sorry I missed out, I have to say.
It is a shame you missed. It was a superb show. I took my friend Susanna along, and, I don't dance. I've never danced in my life, and I never will. But my friend bopped and boogied away through the entire show. She had a great time, and so did the rest of the audience. They were on their feet almost all the way through. It was superb. It was an amazing show, and I was very, very impressed. Like I say, they're playing on the 19th, on Tuesday night in Christchurch. If you're listening to this before then, get yourself there. You'll be glad that you did.
All right, Steve, just about time to go. But is there anything coming up in the next little while we should be keeping an eye out for? I'm just trying to think movie-wise or music-wise.
There's a few things, actually, yes. Yeah. Funny you should mention that. Next week, there's one that does look quite interesting. The opening of Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Okay, this is Tina Fey, isn't it?
That's the one, yes.
Yeah. Yep. Apparently loosely based on an actual story.
Yes, called The Taliban Shuffle.
Yep. I saw the shorts of that. I was Well, I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure. There seemed to be elements of comedy, yes, but also elements of trying to be a bit more serious as well. So it could be quite ambitious. It'd be interesting to see how if they pull it off.
Well, Tina Fey alongside Martin Freeman. So it'd be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out because you've got two very, very different styles of performance there.
Yeah, totally.
That's opening this week. The other end of the spectrum, I'm going this afternoon to a preview of The Jungle Book.
Oh, now I do want to see that. I do want to see that, I must say. Okay, that's interesting.
It does look quite lovely. We're going to see that up in with Manukau this afternoon, and it just looks nice. The original Disney animation from the 60s is one of the most joyful films. The music.
Yeah, I agree.
Ooh, sends shivers, doesn't it?
I don't know. It's one of those things that it's a soundtrack in a movie that stays with you for your life, actually.
Doesn't it?
And on that basis, I would be very keen to see how they've reinterpreted it with modern technology. Yeah,
and there's part of me that says, I can't wait to see it. And there's another part of me that's terrified.
Yeah, in case you're disappointed.
I'm terrified that they're going to desecrate an icon of certainly my childhood, and you clearly have similar levels of affection for this film.
Yes.
I mean, you touched property like that with care.
You do. The little bits I've seen from a trailer, it looks like they've taken a lot of care with it. That's the sense I get. But we'll see when it comes out. Oh, okay, well, I'll try and catch that one too, Steve, and we can have a yarn about that next time. That'd be good.
And in terms of music, the hot property that we mentioned last time that's coming up tomorrow night is 21 Pilots at the Vector Arena.
Oh, right. Yes, yes.
And then also the other big deal is Iron Maiden, which hoping to get along to see that in a couple of weeks. That's going to be enormous fun. So yeah, we've got a lot going on again.
We do. And
I'm sure other things, as they have a tendency to do, will crop up along the way.
I think they shall. Great stuff. Okay, well, this has been Crave. We'll be back soon. If you want to get in touch with us, please do. You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook or you can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
So, I'm Simon Mercier.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that is what has been entertaining us this last week.
Excellent.
Lovely.